The format today is we're going to have some folks talk to us about the life and legacy of Rachel Carson, which is the subtitle of Bill Souder's book, On a Distant Shore. It's gotten great reviews, and I can tell you that they're really well justified. So without any further yammering from me, here's Bill.
Thank you, Randy. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for coming out early in the morning. I hope that I'm not talking too loudly for anybody who had too much fun last night at the Chuck Wagon dinner. But it's great to be here and have a chance to talk about Rachel Carson. Louder? Is that better? We can turn the lights off now. Yep. So here's the reason that we're all here. And by here, I don't mean in Lubbock at the SEJ conference. I mean, this is the reason that we write about the environment. This is the reason that the environment is on the national agenda, and that there is an environmental movement that we have had for the past half century. This is a great photograph of Rachel Carson. This was taken by Irving Penn, the great portrait photographer. It hasn't been seen in 60 years. I managed to dig it out of the archives at Condé Nast. And it's really, really cool. Well, one of the reasons that I wanted to write about Rachel Carson is that a lot of people don't know who she is anymore. If you're 55 or older, a baby boomer, you might remember her. If you are a millennial, teenager, or early 20s, you're likely studying her in school these days. My kids tell me that she's on the AP U.S. History test, so that's encouraging. But I wanted to reintroduce her to people, and so that was one reason that I wrote a book about Carson. The other reason is that I wanted to understand the roots of the environmental movement and also the roots of this partisan right-left argument that we continue to have over the environmental movement. And in fact, the source of that argument is in the reaction to Silent Spring and embedded in the book itself. And I make a distinction in the book between the age of conservationism, which dominated the first half of the 20th century, and environmentalism, which dominated the second half and is with us today. Silent Spring is the fault line between those two important historical periods, and Rachel Carson has a foot in both of those. These are not absolute terms, and we'll probably hear from at least one panelist today about earlier work that preceded Carson on the environment, and that's certainly true. But it's a useful way to think about what happened in 1962. And I'm going to show you right now what I believe to be, as good as any other marker, the exact starting point of the environmental movement.
At his press conference on August 29, 1962, President Kennedy was asked,
"There appears to be growing concern among scientists as to the possibility of dangerous long-range side effects from the widespread use of DDT and other pesticides. Have you considered asking the Department of Agriculture or the Public Health Service to take a closer look at this?"
Yes, I know that they already are. I think particularly, of course, since Ms. Carson's book, but they are examining the matter.
So I think you could probably at least barely hear the president there say a reference Miss Carson's book. And in 1962, in the summer of 1962, there was no further elaboration needed. Everybody knew that he was talking about Silent Spring, even though it wasn't going to be published as a book for another month. In June of 1962, the New Yorker magazine serialized three long excerpts from Silent Spring, and it was a big controversy by the time the president was asked about it at the end of August. And the subject of the book is pesticides, and specifically DDT, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, which was it was actually first synthesized in the 1870s, and it wasn't until 1939 that a Swiss chemist named Paul Muller discovered that it was an insecticide, and Muller would end up winning the Nobel Prize for that discovery. DDT was used throughout World War II in theaters of operation for both on troops and on refugees. And then it was used after the war in a whole bunch of commercial and residential applications. 6 pounds of DDT came into the United States in 1943 for initial testing, and by 1959 we were using about 80 million pounds a year. And I don't know how many of you out there might remember this, but I remember playing behind trucks like this. Yeah. So Carson had a problem to overcome in Silent Spring, and that was to convince people that chemicals could contaminate what she called the total environment, that ecosystems were complex, that ecology was complex, and that certain kinds of pollutants could travel in food chains, through the air, in the soil, by other means. And she realized that this was a novel idea at the time. But she found an exact parallel in another technology that people already understood, and that was radioactive fallout, which was coming down everywhere around the globe. The United States and the Soviet Union were engaged in a fierce arms race, and we were routinely testing nuclear devices above ground in the atmosphere, and in the process sending radioactive debris high into the sky where it would become entrained in high-level winds and then rain back to the surface of the Earth and was contaminating the total environment. And so Carson made this parallel quite explicit in Silent Spring, and I think it's one of the reasons that the book succeeded. And it's also one of the reasons that baby boomers would become the vanguard of the environmental movement, because they got it. They'd grown up understanding the possibilities of nuclear war. They knew what fallout was and what it could do over a very long period of time. They knew that it was invisible, but that it was everywhere. And so this was an exact model for contamination by chemicals. And for Carson, these were existential questions. And I'm going to play a little bit of tape right now where you can listen to Rachel Carson talk about this connection and talk about pesticides.
This is one of the nation's bestsellers, first printed on September 27, 1962. Up to now, 500,000 copies have been sold, and Silent Spring has been called the most controversial book of the year. Biologist Rachel Carson, who also wrote The Sea Around Us, worked 4 years in the preparation of Silent Spring. What she wrote started a national quarrel.
Chemicals are the sinister and little recognized partners of radiation in changing the very nature of the world, the very nature of its life. Since the mid-1940s, over 200 basic chemicals have been created for use in killing insects, weeds, rodents, and other organisms described in the modern vernacular as pests. And they are sold under several thousand different brand names. These sprays, dusts, and aerosols are now applied almost universally to farms, gardens, forests, and homes. Non-selective chemicals that have the power to kill every insect, the good and the bad, to still the song of birds and the leaping of fish in the streams, to coat the leaves with a deadly film, and to linger on in soil. All this, though the intended target may be only a few weeds or insects. Can anyone believe it is possible to lay down such a barrage of poisons on the surface of the earth without making it unfit for all life? They should not be called insecticides, but biocides.
So in that opening scene, you saw Rachel Carson sitting on the porch of her cottage in Maine, and it's on Southport Island, which is near Booth Bay Harbor. It's still there. It's still in the family. It's never really been remodeled. It's maintained, and they rented it to me in the summer of 2010, and so I actually wrote part of the book at Rachel Carson's desk. Well, the reaction to Silent Spring was fierce. The chemical industry raised a war chest, a significant amount of money to combat it. They parodied it. They put out fact sheets explaining what was wrong with it, and they explained to anybody who would listen that Carson was a kook, that she was someone obviously on the far left of the political spectrum, probably a communist, certainly in league with communists and or sympathetic to the Eastern Bloc. The argument was that by reducing our dependence on our use of pesticides, this would bring American agriculture down to parity with the Soviet Union. And so not only was Silent Spring an attack on the chemicals industry, it was also something that was seen as kind of fundamentally un-American, and an argument for having the government reach into the private sector and for the first time really begin to seriously regulate an important class of products. Again, another novel idea at the time, but another reason that Carson was pushed to the left. And so we have essentially this same division today. There's no logical reason why a Republican and a Democrat should have different attitudes about the environment. We all share the same global ecosystem. And I think that the reason that we have divided in this way, there are some obvious reasons having to do with economic considerations, but the roots of that argument are in the reaction to Silent Spring. So I think that, I should mention before I stop and turn it over to the panel, this is Carson at Southport Island in about the mid-1950s. She didn't live to see the environmental movement really get off the ground. She died in early 1974, about a year and a half after Silent Spring came out. She died of breast cancer, which she learned that she had while she was in the middle of writing the cancer chapter for Silent Spring. She certainly was, although she was a very private person, kind of a shy person, she was also quite brave. She stood up to her detractors and to her her illness with equal grace. So I'll end my little thing there, and we're a little cramped for space here, so if we have to shift around from time to time, please bear with us. We have a great panel here today, and I'm eager to hear from all of them. Peter Dykstra is the publisher of Environmental Health News and The Daily Climate. He formerly worked as a producer of environmental stories at CNN, where he won an Emmy, a DuPont Columbia Award, and a Peabody Award. Before that, he worked for Greenpeace. And foolishly, he told me on the way over, he now wants to write a book. I'm going to try to talk him out of it. Florence Williams is an Cynthia Barnett is next. And Cynthia is an independent journalist, and the author of Blue Revolution, Unmaking America's Water Crisis. And we can turn the lights back on now if, okay. Mark Stoll, we're really happy to have here. Mark is Associate Professor of History here at our host institution, Texas Tech University. He is the author of Protestantism, Capitalism, and Nature in America. He has also produced a virtual exhibition on Silent Spring that's at the online Environment and Society portal, and I highly recommend it. It's a really, really good exhibit. And finally, we have another independent journalist, Florence Williams. She is the author of Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. All these people are terrific, and I'm really happy to have them join me here today. We're going to start off with Peter and have him maybe give us a little perspective. Peter, if Silent Spring marks the beginning of environmentalism, bring us forward from 1962 and talk a little bit about the evolution of environmental politics and environmental journalism.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning, everybody. I want to start with a brief and fairly painless two-question quiz for you all. I'm going to read a quote from a president who served in the time since Silent Spring. Restoring nature to its natural state is a cause beyond party and beyond factions. Some of you know the answer to this. Who said that? Which president? Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, old tree-hugging Dick Nixon. That is one measure of where we were as a nation, or at least where Nixon felt he needed to position himself politically as a nation in 1970 and where we are now. Second and final trivia question. Silent Spring marked its 50th anniversary of publication last month. What other American popular cultural phenomenon, and it's a miracle that a science book became a popular cultural phenomenon, but what other pop culture phenomenon celebrated its 50th anniversary last month? The one I had in mind was the premiere of the Beverly Hillbillies. And Bill alluded to this. If you were to take the accomplishments and the courage of Rachel Carson and test her name recognition against the accomplishments of Granny Clampett out by the cement pond stirring a pot full of possum, how many Americans would know Granny Clampett and how many would know Rachel Carson? So when we gather in a room like this, we should bear in mind that we are the proverbial 1%. Although I would hope Rachel's name recognition is at least a little bit higher than that. And what I'm going to do, I've got a little bit less than 5 minutes, and I want to take you through 50 years of what's happened with environmental politics and journalism. And by that, that budgets me about 5 seconds per year, so I'll be quick. Rachel came along at the end of the McCarthy era. She preceded the first Earth Day in publishing Silent Spring by 8 years, although she had had several other best-selling books on the ocean before then. Those are actually the first ones I read before Silent Spring. By 1970, we had had a series of telegenic environmental disasters in this country. The Cuyahoga River caught fire and burned. Truth be told, the Cuyahoga River had already caught fire and burned many times, but in the late 60s, it finally caught fire and burned on national television. The Santa Barbara oil spill, also on national television, also riveting the nation. Concern about species and habitat. And by 1970, the first Earth Day observances were held. The EPA was founded. Nixon signed several critical environmental laws. At least one other, the Clean Water Act, was passed over his veto. But Richard Nixon presided over the most ambitious introduction of environmental law in this country that we've ever seen. That wave, and it was a wave of environmental consciousness, non-government organizations within a few year span, like NRDC, the Environmental Defense Fund, Friends of the Earth, Greenpeace, were founded and began to exert some influence. Already established groups like the World Wildlife Fund and the Sierra Club came into prominence, even though particularly the Sierra Club had been around for a long time. That enthusiasm, that commitment began to wane through the 1970s. Today, one of the most frequently cited environmental journalism events in the 1970s was the infamous 1975 Newsweek cover that talked about global cooling. It is still a fundamental talking point for climate deniers to point out a non-peer-reviewed 37-year-old magazine cover as evidence that global warming is not happening. We got to the 1980s, and there was still that lull. This tends to happen, as I've seen, in 20-year cycles. But by the early 80s, we began to hear the first terrible tolls taken by acid rain. 84 was Bhopal. Then Chernobyl, then the Exxon Valdez, then the first awareness of the ozone hole, the first awareness of serious problems with climate change from Jim Hansen and others. And 20 years after that first peak in 1970, we had another peak in 1990. Earth Day was a two-hour primetime network television special on ABC brought to you by Bette Midler and a young Leonardo DiCaprio. Companies who had, at best, dicey environmental reputations like Dow Chemical and DuPont were falling all over themselves to buy advertising and TV and magazines and newspapers to tout their green values. The word greenwashing was invented from that. Those environmental groups enjoyed a huge rush of new support. New environmental laws were passed in the late 80s in the 88 campaign. Maybe you forgot this. George H.W. Bush promised to be the environmental president. It was something that a Republican ran on as a good thing. And 1990 was the second of those peaks. What else happened in 1990? Environmental beats, including my own, were created. I was hired into CNN in 1991. And SEJ was born in that same time period. Then it began to wane again. And by the time 11 years had passed and we got to September 11th, nothing else mattered. If Bhopal and Chernobyl and the Exxon Valdez and the Cuyahoga River were telegenic events, 9/11 was the mother of all telegenic events, and it steered people away from environmental concern. Then it was topped off by the recession, and environmental concern in some quarters in this country and around the world became not just a thing not to care about, not just a non-priority, it became a bad thing. It became a threat. And the same kind of vitriol that Rachel Carson experienced was and still is being thrown at scientists, at journalists, at advocates, at elected officials who dare speak up about the environment. And for that matter, even Rachel Carson is still being called in some quarters a big mass murderer because she helped lead to a ban on DDT. That's where we are right now, but here's where I think we're going. Those telegenic events that happened that spurred a rise in consciousness. How about the extreme weather this summer? How about the absence of Arctic ice? How about Fukushima? How about the Gulf oil spill? I think we're going there again, and polling data reflects that. We've just seen in the past few days that the trough in the public's acceptance that global warming might actually be a real thing is beginning to bounce back. So we may be coming to that third wave. And I want to make sure that as environmental journalists, we're ready for it. Journalism is in sad shape. SEJ is a proud exception. But we need to be ready for the fact that environmentalism, as an issue, as a story subject, as a political phenomenon, may be on its way back.
Peter, thanks very much. That was a great review. I want to just quickly follow up before we leave you. I thought what was interesting there is that you showed how in the ebb and flow of concern over environmental matters, it always takes a crisis or a tragedy to get us thinking about this again. And my question to you very quickly is, should we be concerned about our inability to look forward and to try to set policy today that will actually help us avoid things in the future?
It's really a dilemma because I'm not asking anybody to hope for the worst. There isn't a day that goes by where I don't hope that every journalist, including myself, who's written about climate change is abjectly wrong and that Mark Morano and Pat Michaels are right. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the science says there's virtually no chance of that happening, but I kind of hope it happens. I would rather be made to look an idiot than have what we think is happening to our planet be about to happen. In terms of looking forward, yes, we need to do a better job of that. And one thing to bear in mind, Bill's book has done a service on this. I hope I've brought up a few points about this. But remember that whether you're an advocate and you're talking about the environmental movement, or whether you're in politics and you're talking about environmental policy, or whether you're a journalist and you're talking about environmental reporting, they have all, with the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring, they have all been around long enough for environmental issues to have a track record. And bear in mind, if you ever find yourself in an argument with somebody who thinks that this is all a hoax, bear in mind that we all have a very proud track record of very sadly being right about far, far, far more things than we've been wrong about.
Thank you, Peter. Dan Fagan and I were cornered by a guy in the bar the other night who wanted to have that exact argument with us. I want to go to Cynthia now, who's written a book about the water crisis. And one of the big challenges that we have in environmental journalism is figuring out a way to reach beyond the choir, to talk to people who are not environmentally minded. And Cynthia's had some success in doing that. And I'd like Cynthia to talk to us a little bit about what she's done to go beyond simply writing a book about the water crisis and find a way to actually talk to people and maybe expand that discussion beyond people who would necessarily read a book about water.
Thank you. So when I wrote for newspapers and magazines, I never had this great opportunity that I have now to go out and talk to groups of everyday people about my journalism. And that's what I really do now with the books. So spending a lot more time with readers as opposed to spending almost all of my work time with sources has me convinced. I feel differently about this than Peter. I feel that there is a vast caring middle in this country that is not as divided as we seem to believe they are, and as we frame our stories to reflect. And I think this caring middle is also sick of political division and isn't as fractured on environmental issues as we think they are. And I've really seen that in water. So I think a lot about how to appeal to this caring middle. And I think the optimism or hope that Dr. Hayhoe talked about is a really big part of it. Dr. Hayhoe actually cited research that showed people literally cannot hear you when you dump too much bad news on their heads. And I've really seen that happen in my talks. I found when I give a talk that had a bit too much devastating news in it, I can really see it in the audience's faces. I can see their eyes glaze over. And there is a lot of bad news in my talks. You know, as you've learned over the past few days, if you're talking about something as devastating as the managed depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, that is really depressing. But I try both in my speeches and my books, and I think I've managed to do this in both books, I try to balance the devastating water stories with stories that show it absolutely doesn't have to be this way. So that balance of exposé with solutions or hope is really what I think has led my books to, you know, appeal to more of the general public, more people who you may not think of as environmental-minded readers. So it's led to my books being chosen for community reads or for college reads, and now for some church reads, which has really taken some getting used to. But I am figuring out how to engage with those church audiences. So Dr. Hayhoe and another speaker from the Canyon Tour, the English professor Ken Bakke, they both talked about writing in a way that helps people feel good about the values they have and not make them feel bad about those values. And that's particularly hard for me because I go all over the country telling average people that the American lawn is a huge problem. That's just one example of the bad news I go around telling people about their own values. But I do it in a way that gives them an escape route. So I blame the illusion of water abundance, which lets me take it all the way back to Louis XIV and the fountains of Versailles. I blame America's water industrial complex. I tell a story that is much larger than their lawns, and next thing you know, they're coming up and asking all sorts of questions about rainwater catchment. I also think writing about history really appeals to the caring middle, and I think we saw that in the Ken Burns documentary on Friday night. And I'm so glad that we have an environmental historian on our panel. When I found out I was coming to Lubbock, one of the first things I did was email Dr. Stoll so that I could interview him for my new book, which is it's a human and natural history of rain. The working title is Rain, a Love Story. And I will often just zero in on the environmental historian who specializes in whatever it is I'm writing about. Mark has actually written a book with the words rain and love in the title, although it wasn't as perfect a match as I wanted it to be, but he definitely gave me some threads that I can follow. So another thing, I think writing about economics appeals to the caring middle, which doesn't understand the extent to which they are, for example, subsidizing some of the worst agricultural crops for our aquifers, or in the climate change story, the extent to which they're subsidizing oil and gas. I think when middle America understands the economics of some of those issues, we do see pressure on Congress, and we really saw that in the debate over corn ethanol. When it comes to religious audiences, I am not a religious person, so I can't be something that I'm not. And so I would not ask the God question that Professor Bakke suggested. When we were on our Canyon tour, he suggested that we can ask questions like, what do you think God wants you to do with this farmland? And Jeff Burnside asked the congressman a version of that question at lunch yesterday. I wouldn't do that because that question does not feel authentic for me. So the way I've connected with churches and religious people is to simply talk about water as an issue of stewardship or justice and try not to pretend that I know something about the Bible. Finally, as a last point, I found that when I write as a mother, or when I bring children into my journalism in any way, it absolutely hooks the sort of audiences that we're talking about. And one thing I really like about Florence's book is that she writes about her own mother, she writes about herself, and she writes about her children. And that just hooked me in the opening pages of her book. Readers love that. It gives our journalism great authenticity. And I also don't think you have to be a parent to do that. There's no better way to connect with fellow human beings than trying to connect over their children and grandchildren. So those are my opening remarks, and thank you very much.
Thanks, Cindy. That's great, great perspective. You know, The environmental movement did begin on a note of pessimism. Silent Spring is a pretty dismal book, and so that's been part of our DNA from the very beginning. And then for a long time, environmental reporters had to overcome the notion that editors held, that every single issue has two equal arguments on opposite sides. And it was a real challenge to figure out how to do that. And we've kind of won that battle, or we've mostly won it. You're talking about something slightly different. So for reporters who aren't necessarily going to be talking to groups, but are going to be just confronting this on a daily basis, how do you incorporate a little more optimism in a story?
That's a good follow-up question, and I don't just do that in my speeches, and I don't just do that in my books. When I write a story, or when I write an op-ed, there is plenty of investigative reporting in my work. There is a lot of hard-hitting data in my work, but every time I hit you over the head with some devastating amount of information, I try to balance it out. Again, with an anecdote about how it absolutely doesn't have to be this way. So, you know, if we write some of these stories, I think there's always a way to come back in and either end it with a little note of hope or just talk about solutions somewhere in the world. For Blue Revolution, I went all over the world to show people how we could live differently with water. So I went to those places where people really seem to have an ethic for water that we don't have in our country. But you don't have to travel around the world to do that. I learned about the places I wanted to go just from being a reporter. And every time I wrote about a particular, like if I were going to write the story, which I think Brett is working on, about cotton here, being grown in the Ogallala, then I would say, and here's the dryland farmer, and, you know, just give them that. We all, you know, that is just part of the story. To me, that's basic reporting, that the other side of the story is not necessarily the two divisive sides. It is, here's what's happening now, and here's how we could live differently.
Thanks, Cynthia. I'm going to turn to, and by the way, the reason I keep doing musical chairs up here is we're not sure the microphone is going to reach down to Florence, so we'll keep thinking about this while Mark answers the next question. Mark, you've written about the international reception of Silent Spring. I mean, this is a book that is pretty grounded in the scene in America, but there definitely was a response to Silent Spring overseas. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the impact of Silent Spring outside the United States.
Thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to talk to you all. This is my, kind of a group outside of my comfort zone. I usually, it's different talking to somebody who writes for the public rather than for each other, although perhaps you do that somewhat yourself too. What's really interesting is that, of course, Silent Spring was translated into dozens of languages on really, really quickly. And was sold many thousands of copies outside the United States, but in the most of the literature that you read, it's almost all about the United States and the big debate here, which is not too surprising, since actually one of the main parts of the reviews abroad of the book tended to remark on the amazing controversy that the book had stirred up the United States. It was one of the first things they always mentioned. But there's just a list of all of the translations that I could find of the book. This is not talking about second and third editions or anything. And then also abridged selections were also published, extensive selections were published in a variety of popular venues. So it would be really difficult to have avoided knowing something about Rachel Carson's book, especially in Europe. But what's interesting is how differently each nation responded. If anything, in Sweden, the controversy was even greater than the United States. They were primed to accept to understand what was going on from some controversies that had been going on in Sweden. First of all, their birds had been disappearing, so this really hit home. The falcons had been disappearing. One of the main problems was that in Sweden and England and some other countries, they had been treating seed to sow with. And the birds, of course, once you plant it, the birds will then descend on the field and eat the treated seed, and the birds were dying off from that. And this had caused great alarm in Sweden. They were also very concerned about an entirely different subject that just made them much aware of invisible poisons, and that was mercury in their water due to all of the paper plants, the wood treatment plants that they had, you know, forestry being a major, lumber being a major industry in Sweden. And so this had all been in the news recently, and everyone was alarmed about, of course, mercury is a terrible poison to have in your water. Everybody was alarmed about that, and then along comes Silent Spring that told them about these other poisons. So Sweden was responded quite quickly. They were the first nation, I believe, to actually ban DDT. So, and they're also the first nation to have an equivalent of the EPA, I think in 1967. So they moved really quickly. This is just one of the newspaper articles about the Rachel Carson's book. It says in Swedish, when birdsong falls silent. Britain had also a rather amazing reaction. This is Lord Shackleton, who wrote the preface to the British edition, and he also was part of an amazing five-hour debate in the House of Lords over Silent Spring. 5 hours given in the House of Lords given to a debate over just its claims. Britain, too, was primed to receive this, but they, in a different way. They had already taken some action against pesticides because about a decade earlier there had been an incident in which 8 farm workers had died from a weed killer. That immediately had sent alarm flags up about these. And so Britain had already been keeping an eye on this stuff. They had also had the exact same issue about treated seed and killing off of birds, which had alarmed them. So they were already dealing with this. And in the future, they would continue to keep a much closer eye on pesticides and these chemicals than the United States would and be quick to regulate them when the evidence was there. They were also the ones that set up the research stations that discovered that DDT caused the thinning of eggshells. Which has led to major restriction of it, of course. It was a very important piece of the puzzle. That happened in Britain. And all of this happens mainly at the government level and without the public input or public controversy that it had in the United States. So it's not a kind of a bottom-up pressure at all like it is pretty much in the U.S. And so you don't create an environmental movement on anything like the scale in the United States. The Netherlands is the other nation that responded most to Silent Spring. These are from a Dutch newspaper publication of excerpts of Silent Spring. It's just got the most lurid illustrations of any I've ever found. Most of the European stories about it just reproduced either illustrations from the book or pictures that are like the one in Sweden, which you find very, very common. It was only in this weekly newspaper in the Netherlands that I find that they had commissioned somebody to do these drawings, and you should find them. It appeared over several editions and several weeks, and each one was pretty gruesome. So something's going to shock you, this would shock you. Also, one of Rachel Carson's most important correspondents, C.J. Briere, was Dutch, and they had talked about, he was the one that discovered the fact that insects were getting resistance to these pesticides, especially to DDT, and he had written about this in Dutch, and she had had it translated. She discovered it in the Long Island case. It was entered as evidence in the Long Island suit of 1958. Which is one of the places that Rachel Carson got a lot of her initial information. They initiated correspondence, and they wrote back and forth until Rachel Carson died. C.J. Briere regarded Rachel Carson as his hero. He just absolutely adored her and adored the book, and he himself would write a book in Dutch called Silver Veils and Hidden Showers or something like that about pesticides in the Netherlands. The Netherlands, however, is a much more technocratic kind of society than America. I mean, look at the way they control their nature. And the pretty much the controversies remained inside government and policy circles and, again, did not become popular movement. You can go to Germany. You would think the Germans might have responded, but they really didn't, although the German edition was sponsored by bird groups and nature groups in Germany, the German translation. And there are a lot of very alarming headlines. If you can read German, I won't translate them all, but they're all about being poisoned and more dangerous than radioactivity and the poisoning of our nature and poison on God's gifts and still and so on. But the basic reaction is captured by the headline at the top that says, German science has insecticides under control. Don't worry. We've got it all under control here. And you find this actually the way that Europe reacts is different because most of Rachel Carson's examples come from the United States, and nobody in Europe was applying insecticides from airplanes, which they thought was just absolutely insane. Why would anybody do it from airplanes? It just boggled people's minds. So it's a little thing in the box at the top says, no danger yet, but take care. Be careful. So as long as you're careful, everything's fine. The government has it in control. The same thing happens in France. There is a big discussion. She has big champions there as well. The head of the Natural History Museum in Paris writes the preface to the Paris to the French edition. And he himself would write his own book. And you see that if you can read French, that a lot of these headlines are quite alarming. It's just like the German ones. But the same thing happened, that the French had established an agency to deal with pesticides, to regulate them, under Vichy France in the 1930s. But the purpose of that, and so everybody said, oh, don't worry, we've already got an organization that's keeping your food safe. We wouldn't do anything that would poison, you know, that would make anything be anything to worry about. But in actuality, this agency, pretty much like the EPA, actually, was there to tell the farmers that these chemicals were effective. In other words, to regulate them so that the farmer would know that he was buying something that wasn't fake or oversold or whatever, that it was actually effective. So it was much more geared to agriculture and not to the protection of the consumer or protection of health. And it would take a long time for the French to actually come around to that. In the meantime, they are cheerfully eating their fromage and everything else and drinking their wine, thinking it's healthy, whereas there's really not very much regulation of the use of pesticides in France at all. If you travel south in Europe, the reaction to Silent Spring gets less. And part of the problem was, of course, that Europe is in a different stage of economic growth than the United States. The United States is booming by the 1960s. Europe is still kind of coming out of that post-World War II rebuilding. And they're nowhere near the prosperity that America is at this point. And they're not ready to question the economic boom yet. The United States is now at the point where we could, but Europe was not going to question the economic wonder that was just now bringing back prosperity in the early 60s. And it would not be until the 70s and 80s that you really see the European Green Movement take off. I think that's probably enough.
Mark, thanks. That's a great perspective. I want to ask a brief follow-up question. And in looking at your online exhibit and listening to you just now, it's clear that in many countries outside of the United States, there was an admission that there might be similar problems in their own front yard, but this undercurrent of belief that they were either already dealing with them or they couldn't possibly be as serious as they were in the United States. And I wonder if that was in part conditioned by the way the rest of the world looked at the Cold War and this sort of stupid arms race that the United States and the Soviet Union were engaged in. Do you think that maybe there was just this sort of default position that they couldn't possibly be as stupid as we were?
I haven't seen any connection between that and the arms race of the Cold War. Cold War is an interesting aspect because, of course, the communists just said, well, that's capitalism for you. And in the meantime, of course, they're at least as bad or worse in their application of chemicals. But other than that, I'm not really sure that I've seen any remarks or comparisons about Cold War or atomic bombs.
Well, we're going to talk to Florence a little bit now. And let me just say before we get to Florence that for this session, we want to have as much time as possible for Q&A. So after this sort of initial round, we're going to go ahead and open it up. I think we go to 10 today. And so we want to leave time for you guys to ask all of us questions. Well, Rachel Carson was, when she wrote Silent Spring, was already one of the most famous and beloved writers in America, and she had gotten there on the strength of these three books she wrote about the ocean, which were always described as elegant and poetic. And she certainly brought those writing talents to bear in Silent Spring, but that was also a very angry book. Silent Spring is a dismal book to read, and I want to ask Florence if she thinks that writers today, if we can get away with engaging readers in that way, or whether we need to take a different tone. And I think Florence had some experience in her book on breasts with trying a different approach.
Thanks, Bill. Before I answer that, I just want to tell Peter that another big event happened in 1962. So this is the 50th anniversary of the invention of the silicone breast implant. So for the environmental history of the breast, it was a big deal. Well, I think, you know, the way that question is set up, the answer is predictable. I think we all know that we can't really write books that are, you know, sort of sententious or preachy or full of rage. And, you know, if you want to reach a wide audience, which Rachel Carson certainly did, tone is very important. And tone is a construct. It's something that all writers think about. She thought, I'm sure, very hard about her tone. And, you know, if you look at someone like Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was writing about slavery, much earlier, the effective approach she had was to write a novel. And Rachel Carson was really writing at a time that was kind of still the age of authority, an authorial voice. And she was coming from a perspective of a time where people were used to hearing sort of moralistic political speech. Certainly when her book came out, people were very familiar with Martin Luther King. They were familiar with John F. Kennedy. And I think she very much, sort of took that mantle on and could get away with it because she'd had this history of sort of elegance and a poetic quality to her writing. But if you read it today, it's kind of striking. I mean, she has sentences such as, if we are going to live with these chemicals, we must know what's in them. Or we should know. And I think, as a writer, I don't think I could really get away with that. And certainly some writers today try. And I, as a reader, find myself alienated pretty quickly. I end up sort of throwing those books against the wall. I don't necessarily want to name examples, but there are writers today who, will say things like, my child has never eaten a Twinkie. And I live on a farm with... where I grow all my own food, and you should too. And, that's just not speaking to me. So maybe it speaks to a few people. But I think, for those of us who really want to try to approach a wide audience, and Cynthia certainly addressed this, I like that term, the thinking center, or
the caring middle,
the thinking center. One way to do it is sort of by engaging history and by engaging common values. But another way to do it is through tone. So how do we today establish our authority? We still need to be authoritative, but we're living in this postmodern age, right, where everything is about subjectivity. We don't really believe in authority. And yet, we want our writers to believe us and to trust us. So, you often see sort of popular environmental books or science books that incorporate the first person or that incorporate humor. And I certainly try to do both of those things a little bit because I still need to be trusted by my reader and I need to sort of bring them along. Today, if you want to write a best-selling environmental book, one approach a lot of people have is to write a memoir, sort of the environmental memoir or what Dan Fagan calls the toxic memoir. This really started, I think, with Terry Tempest Williams, maybe her book Refuge, in which she wrote about fallout and breast cancer in her family. And then you also have books like Sandra Steingraber's Living Downstream. And I think Nancy Langston, an environmental historian, did it really well with a book called Toxic Bodies, in which she wrote about DES. But she was a historian, and so she still brought her field and her experience to bear. I think the problem with a lot of these environmental memoirs is that they're written by non-scientists, and they're often written by non-journalists. And so you end up, I think, with a trust problem sometimes with the data and the science. So that's a pitfall. And then you have people like, Jonathan Hare, who wrote Civil Action, and the Aaron Brockovich books. Those books really succeeded because they dramatized an event, and they were very, very close to a character. And science writer Rebecca Skloot got really close to her characters, and then, in fact, also made herself a character in the book. That wasn't really an environmental book, but as a science book, I think, you know, it's sort of flabbergasting how well it's done, and it obviously reached a lot of people. So those are the challenges we have, and certainly I have tried through tone to be sort of likable, and politicians understand this. If we want to be trusted, we have to be likable. So that's one approach I have.
Thanks, Florence. Florence named some terrific books, but I would say that if your goal is to write a best-selling book about the environment, you should probably see a counselor, not an editor. Because good luck. There are headwinds. I want to follow up very quickly with a question that I get asked all the time, and that is, could it happen again? Setting aside tone and just looking at the impact of Silent Spring, is there any chance we'll see another book like that that will address a massive problem with as much impact as Rachel Carson had? I think if you take Silent Spring and substitute in climate change for pesticides, the argument plays out the same way. People line up on the same sides of the argument in exactly the same way. On one side, you'll have industry and its allies in government, and on the other side, you'll have science, data, and some appreciation for the natural order. So my question really is, are we ever going to see another Silent Spring?
You know, I think we're really living in a different age. There have been a lot of great books out about climate change, terrific ones, and they're not hitting the bestseller list. So I think, you know, the atmosphere of political discourse is such that this topic, you know, for better or for worse right now, is kind of poisoned. You know, it's just really fractious, and it's Rachel Carson was sort of lucky. I mean, she was coming in at a time when people were really open-minded about these issues. Not all of them, of course, but a lot of people. And now, I mean, we're at a disadvantage. You know, the stage has been set. The divisions have been made. So again, I think if we're going to reach people, we have to reach them through emotion. And we have to do that, I think, through drama and through voice. And really, if you want to write a best-selling environmental book, I think you need to write Eat, Pray, Love, Get Cancer, Blame a Toxin.
Can I have that idea? Thank you, everybody. We will. We're going to open it up now, and this is a more informal session here this morning. Please relax if you need a refill on coffee. If your head really hurts, rest it on your hand. But do follow the normal protocol. SEJ members first, please. And if you could stand up and tell us who you are, we'll be happy to take your questions now. Bill makes a good point. We can go to the pitch slam in a little bit and hear if the next Silent Spring is about to be written. So with that, let's hear from you.
Repeat every question into the microphone.
Okay. Tom.
I was going to ask you.
Now tell us who you are.
Oh, Tom Henry at the Toledo Blade.
Okay. No, of course not. Tom asked why I thought I could write this book and why I thought I should write this book. And I touched on that briefly at the outset. I was appalled that one of the most important people of the 20th century, one of the most important American women in history, was largely unknown to so many people. But I also have long been curious about this, the way we talk about the environment and why it is such a divisive partisan issue. And I really wanted to find the roots of that and by exploring Carson's life. My interests are science, history, environment, natural history, and Rachel Carson sort of embodies all of those things. Her life and her work kind of take you through all of that. And so she was just a perfect subject for me. It's always great when you are writing a book if you have a story, a very elemental story. And in biography, you start off with a main character and a beginning, a middle, and the end. And that's a huge advantage to a writer. The other thing that was important, and I'm giving you all logistical advice because sometimes it's useful, I took a very close look at the material before I started. I spent some time at Yale going through the Carson papers before I wrote my proposal because I wanted to know what was there. And in the case of Rachel Carson, everything is there. She is one of those people that saved everything she ever wrote, everything that was ever written to her. So going back to her high school themes, her whole life, from the era of print when people wrote letters and kept carbons, were in those records. And so I just thought she was a terrific subject. And as a completely a practical matter, I knew the 50th anniversary of Silent Spring was coming along, and I thought if I got my foot in the door first, I'd scare everybody else off the subject. And it worked. Yeah. So I think I'm going to ask Peter maybe to field this one since he's our resident historian. Dan Fagan asks what we can deduce from the fact that Silent Spring seems to come in and out of fashion, and there have been times since its publication a half century ago when it seems to animate or become relevant to the public agenda once again. Peter, maybe you want to talk about that?
I'll give it a try. I'm flattered that you would pick me to answer this question, that being the one person here who's never written a book, and I worked in TV for 20 years, so I can hardly read. That would be interesting. I can't imagine that it wouldn't yield some valuable data to see how those books have waxed and waned. I think just as an observer, and not as an author, the book field seems a little skewed these days. Cynthia Barnett does not sell books on her hour-long Cynthia Barnett shout fest on Fox News, and then she turns to the Cynthia Barnett syndicated radio show on right-wing talk shows around the country. If you look at the titles that make the bestseller lists, those kinds of books tend to skew. O'Reilly writes a book about Lincoln and history, for God's sake, and it's at the top of the list. It's on his show every night, and for that matter, he's on The Daily Show talking about his book, The Daily Show, Bill O'Reilly. I think it's inherently a harder market. Being the Philistine who's never written a book, I think I probably shouldn't press the question any further. And maybe our historian, would you like to take a crack at that?
Except that I haven't tracked the sales of Silent Spring, so I don't really know how it's gone up and down. Edition, when was that? Late 90s, I think, with Al Gore's preface. Probably boosted it quite a bit. The current edition is the preface is by somebody else. I forget who.
Well, Linda Lear.
Linda Lear's got, but she, I think she's had been in there for a while. But in any case, of course, Al Gore really helped. And then he vanished from the face of the earth. And he's not really being very helpful these days, is he? But I can't address that more directly.
Cynthia, Florence, any perspective on the waxing and waning of Silent Spring?
I would just say to Dan, that seems like a great multimedia project for a journalism student. You know, be good on a blog.
I don't have a comment on that per se, but I will mention something that I sort of wanted to mention here. I absolutely love Bill's biography. I recommend that you all go purchase it after this event and get his signature. My one tiny nitpick that he knows about is that I feel dating the environmental movement to one moment in 1962 does a disservice to some of the environmental writers who came before. So some of you have heard me talk before about Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who publishes River of Grass in 1947, really changes the way many people view swamps and what we now call wetlands drainage. So there's sometimes a distinction made between conservation writers and environmental writers, And I think there were real, you know, environmental journalists. Marjorie was a newspaper reporter for the Miami Herald. She's writing about sewage going straight into the bays of Florida and so on. So I wanted to say, you know, some of these other books were also quite popular. What was the George Perkins Marsh book, Man and Nature? Even though that's in the 1890s, that too doesn't feel like lyrical conservation. That was a sort of a hard-hitting look at what was going to happen as we developed this country, you know, looking at too much growth and what we were doing. So I guess I wanted to give a nod to a couple of other people.
And I'm glad you did, Cynthia. Cynthia is absolutely right. There is a continuum, and I use these terms, and maybe they were a clumsy choice to distinguish, you know, before Silent Spring and after Silent Spring. And I only mean that there was a cataclysmic event in 1962 that changed the tenor of the conversation. Yes. It didn't invent out of thin air environmentalism. It put it on, it put it front and center of the American conscience in a way that it hadn't been before. But Cynthia's absolutely right. A lot of important people worked on conservation before it became environmentalism, including Rachel Carson, who worked for many years for the Fish and Wildlife Service and wrote a lot about conservation issues. Christine? So Christine asks if there is a greater awareness of environmental issues now reflected in popular culture, where themes are often of post-apocalyptic landscapes or catastrophes that involve environmental themes. It's an interesting idea that I frankly have never thought of. You know, genre fiction and filmmaking and television work goes in and out of fashion. We should maybe ask our TV guy about this, but anybody that wants to weigh in.
This one is, I'm a little closer to this than I am to the books I haven't written, but there are two genres of popular culture and environment epics. The people stories that are, as far as I know, somewhat true to real life, and a good example is A Civil Action, which is based on the Superfund site in Woburn, Massachusetts. It became a book. It became a movie. I think Florence referenced it earlier. Then there's Waterworld, where Kevin Costner is on a bleak, sea-level risen planet with no land in sight, and he's got gills, but he gets the girl. And then there's was it The Day After Tomorrow? The movie about with the Dick Cheney surrogate evil vice president denying climate change, and New York, you can't get a cab in Manhattan because overnight it's under 60 feet of ice, and the scientist again gets the girl. You have those things. You have other things that portray scientists cartoonishly. One of the things, as much as she is a hero, Rachel Carson probably did little to deflect the stereotype of conservationists and nature lovers. And I'll reach my quota of Beverly Hillbillies analogies, but the Miss Jane in the Beverly Hillbillies was a bird watcher. And that was the nation's cliche of what people who cared about the environment looked like and how they acted and what they did. You can go to the current day. The Big Bang Theory, which has been a more recent big hit on TV, is about science nerds and just how adorably, what adorable losers they are. So there are those two schools. And on one hand, they help frame issues and introduce information. On the other hand, sometimes they make bad stereotypes and set people back.
Anybody else want to weigh in? All right, well, I think we've got Peter's book, The World According to the Beverly Hillbillies. Let me go just a little bit further back, and then I'll... Yeah. Can you tell us who you are, please? I'm not sure I get the whole comment, but the suggestion is there's a book by David Kirby.
Lab coats
lab coats in Hollywood that perhaps addresses this issue about the connection between popular culture and environmental issues? More specifically, science. Randy. Tell us who you are, Randy. Well, so Randy makes a point that sometimes packaging is important to selling a book, and that is certainly true. I don't think anybody knows for sure what will or won't work. My hunch is the decision on a civil action, they just got lucky, because really it's always hindsight that tells you whether it did or didn't work. And then Randy also asked about how significant Rachel Carson's editor, Paul Brooks, was. Paul Brooks was at Houghton Mifflin, and he kind of stole Carson away from Oxford University Press initially to write The Edge of the Sea, which started out as simply a guidebook that Carson was going to write to for beachcombers, and then remained her editor throughout the balance of her career. I think that what happened with Carson Brooks was that he had contracted for The Edge of the Sea just before The Sea Around Us was published. And The Sea Around Us, for those of you who don't know, came out in 1951. It was serialized by The New Yorker. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 39 consecutive weeks. It led to the reissue of an earlier book by Carson that had never sold at all. And at one time, she had two books on the bestseller list at the same time in the top 10. And she won the National Book Award for The Sea Around Us. By the way, the other winners that year were Marianne Moore for poetry and James Jones for From Here to Eternity. And Jones was a compromise winner. He was in a really crappy mood that night because everybody in the room knew that he won because there had been a tie with the jury between Herman Woke for The Caine Mutiny and this funny little book about a teenager named Holden Caulfield, The Catcher in the Rye. So they canceled each other out. So anyway, Brooks had kind of by accident landed suddenly the most famous writer in America. And she got stuck on The Edge of the Sea and ended up turning it in about 3 years late. And I think part of what made Brooks so important in her life was that he was patient with her. And he probably figured he should be because he knew that he was going to have a bestseller as soon as it came out. But if you read, as I did, the correspondence between editor and writer that went on over the course of many years of missed deadlines, it's heartbreaking. We've all been there. We've all, you know, offered the excuse for why it won't be in next month when it was supposed to be. And Brooks's ability to sort of manage Carson through that difficult period was important. He edited Silent Spring. He was a huge help to her on that. It was a book she never planned to write, and it was a hard book, and he gave her wise counsel all the way through. Brooks was so important in Carson's life that when she died, she had adopted her grandnephew, who was orphaned, just before she died. He was about 6 or 7 when she died. And Carson didn't know what was going to happen to Roger after she was gone, and she actually specified in her will that Paul Brooks and his wife would become Roger's guardians. She never mentioned this to Paul Brooks. He found out when they read the will, and Paul Brooks raised Roger. So he was important to her. Yeah, Elizabeth. So Lizzie Grossman asks a great question and points out something we have maybe overlooked. Some books that have been, in their own way, as big as Silent Spring, like The Population Bomb, like The End of Nature. What was the third one? Oh, An Inconvenient Truth, obviously. Yeah, somebody want to take a shot at that?
Well, I would actually like to hear Peter answer it, because Peter recently blogged about, I think it was the top 5 environmental books of all time, and I think I agreed with all but one. The first two were Silent Spring and A Sand County Almanac, but the Al Gore book was one. So if you could explain why you didn't include those other books and maybe the context for your own list.
The piece that Cynthia is talking about, something at MNN.com asked me to do. It's on their website. It's also on the EHN.org website, and I'd really rather you give my site the web traffic and look at it there. Lizzie, those are absolutely good books. And Cynthia, and when we were emailing back and forth and preparing for this discussion, you didn't intend to, but you reminded me that I completely forgot Marjorie Stoneman Douglas's book. There were a few others. River of Grass belongs on that list. I only had room for five. Another one is Cadillac Desert, which I think is the closest thing in an environmental book to the words that Hollywood uses, like a sweeping, sprawling epic about water in the West. The one that's on the list is actually a different Al Gore book, McKibben's book, The End of Nature is Good. Although it's not my favorite Bill McKibben book, he wrote one called The Age of Missing Information, where he watched 24 hours worth of simultaneous content from 120 channels on the Fairfax County, Virginia cable TV system without going insane. And that included like a dozen televangelist channels and home shopping channels and everything else. And then he went off to a mountaintop and wrote about it all, and how what we see in popular culture and what we see on TV kind of misses the boat about the real values of life. But the Al Gore book, not an Inconvenient Truth, but his earlier book, Earth in the Balance, was really striking to me for two reasons. I read it when it came out. I kind of skimmed through it in writing the piece that Cynthia talked about. It was astounding how many things he was prescient on. This is a United States senator, for goodness sake. Sometimes they're not so prescient. In all of the issues that we're looking at today, not just climate change and biodiversity, but things like antibiotics in farming and in the food supply. The other thing that struck me about Earth in the Balance is that, like Al Gore himself, it's fallen off the face of the earth and it's not referred to anymore. But I looked at it and I was struck by how prophetic it is 20 years later.
We just have 1 minute left, so if we can get Mark, I think, wants to address us, and Cynthia. I'm sorry, Florence also, so if we can kind of quickly get to it.
I think it's an...
One more question.
All right. I think it's an interesting question because particularly Population Bomb sold far more copies than Silent Spring ever has. 3 million. I don't know if you've tried to read it now. It's just appallingly bad. It's just Silent Spring you can read over and over again. I still assign it to my students, and many of them are just had no idea. I mean, which is alarming that they had no idea after 50 years. That this such a thing could go on. But I don't know that, I mean, it's such a melodramatic potboiler, Paul Ehrlich. It's just so extreme. But maybe what sold 3 million copies was the fact that he was on for an hour on The Tonight Show when the other guests didn't show up. he was supposed to be on for 5 minutes. We're going to talk about his new book with, what's his name?
Johnny Carson.
And Johnny Carson was absolutely, yes, right, the other Carson. And he was so absolutely fascinated. He just talked for an hour, and then the next day, you know, it was off the charts. That's why that was such an important book. I don't know. But and that issue also has sort of disappeared, population control. His solutions were definitely unworkable, and maybe unworkable solutions are the problem with that. I don't know. But anyway, it's interesting to compare the two books, though, because one was far more, you know, you would think it would have much greater impact, but nobody reads it anymore.
Yeah, that's similar to what I was going to say. And also, I think, to some degree, those books already preach to the choir a little bit. I mean, The Population Bomb, obviously, I think, reached a huge audience, but the issue went away, and it didn't lead to legislative. None of those books really led to meaningful change in the way that Rachel Carson's book really so clearly did. And it would be nice if there were books that could do that again. But
I was at a meeting once. Paul Ehrlich was one of the speakers, and he started off by saying that he was a living monument to tenure. And I think that's probably true. Okay, so we have time for one more question, Jay. Yeah, right over here. So the question is, was Rachel Carson interested in, tell me the book again, because I don't know it. Jane Jacobs. Death and Life of Great American Cities. I don't know that book. I never came across that book in the course of researching Rachel Carson. My hunch is no. Remember that Carson was desperately ill by the time Silent Spring was published, so she wasn't doing very much. She did manage to testify in Congress. She did manage to do an hour-long documentary for CBS News, which is where those clips came from. But I don't know about, I don't know that book, and I don't know that Carson knew anything about it.
Mark.
Well, I think that those two books, one is about the city, and the other really never mentions the city. And I don't really think that what Jane Jacobs was aware of had anything to do with, you know, what Silent Spring was about, and vice versa. They just, it's as if they were on parallel tracks or in two different worlds. A better question, was Jane Jacobs aware of Silent Spring? I'll bet that Rachel Carson wasn't all that aware of the city book.
Okay. A great suggestion from Dan Fagan that Bill McKibben's anthology of environmental writing is a great resource for looking at all these people we've been talking about today. Again, I want to thank you all for coming out early in the morning. I want to thank our terrific panel for joining me here today. And I want to just leave you with the thought that while we'd all like to have bestsellers, we'd all like to write the next Silent Spring, those of us who write books, the work that we do manage to do is important. The work that Mark and Peter are doing, the books that that Cynthia and Florence have written, these have real value. It's important to do them. So if you think you want to write a book, don't be discouraged at the possibility that the readership may ultimately be small. It's worth doing. If you can find a way to do it, I encourage you to follow that dream. So thanks.